Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to episode 1 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you inspiring stories, expert training advice and essential information on all things running. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, what have we got coming up on this month's episode?
Oh, it's a ram-packed episode. In The Big Debate, we'll be discussing with Runner's World reader Maud Hodson why she thinks it's high time that men and women run the same distance across country. In Human Race, we'll be meeting Kevin Webber, a man who's running to raise awareness of prostate cancer. And finally, our race section, where we take a look at The Swimmer, a very unique swim-run event that's taking London by storm.
Well, on the subject of taking London by storm, that's exactly what we're planning to do over at Runner's World, because on Saturday, 24th of March, we'll be assembling a crack team of relay runners to take on the London's Peaks Relay, which involves running to the highest points in each of the 32 London boroughs as part of a giant relay.
It's going to be interesting.
It certainly is going to be interesting. It's a bit like the Bob Graham round with a bit more concrete. There's various peaks and we're putting together a team. We've got most people involved, and we'd also like to throw it open to some Runner's World readers. We've got two places left for the final leg, which goes from Hammersmith and Fulham to the City of Westminster to snow-capped peaks, as you can imagine. So if you fancy joining the team, you can email in at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
Runner's World Podcast.
So we're very pleased to have Maud Hodson with us in the studio. Maud is a member of the East London Runners and wrote into Runner's World to discuss her exasperation at the current cross-country running format, which sees men and women running different distances to one another. Maud, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, I mean, what do you see as wrong with the current format? Why do you think men and women should actually run the same distances?
Well, I think as it is at the moment, it doesn't give the women's event equal status to the men's. Taking as an example the Southern Maine Championship, the men's event will be 15 kilometres and the women's will be 8, so just over half. If you took the London Marathon as an example, that would be as if the men ran 26.2 miles and the women ran 14 miles. We wouldn't stand for that. It wouldn't give the women the same sort of challenge. So why should we put up with it in cross country? We race the same distances on the tracks, on the roads, but in cross country, up through the junior ranks, women are always one step behind. The senior women run the same as the junior boys. The junior girls run the same distance as the younger boys.
Do you feel that this devalues the women's race?
Yes, I do, because in regional competitions, you know, throughout the season, we're running 8K cross countries here, there and everywhere. And for the men, they get a great big season ender. They get 15K. They get a big showpiece event. We get another 8K. Great.
I'll try and do a counter-argument. I've done a few of these cross-country events for Herne Hill, and I know that they're very packed schedules, and you think there's a lot of races, like, say, junior events, men's events, women's events. If you made the women's event longer, would it be difficult to pack into that, to sort of fit into that schedule, you think?
Well, that is one of the arguments I've heard for keeping things as they are. But if they've got time for the men to run a longer event, are they saying that the men's race is more important and they can afford more time in the schedule? That's not a great argument, in my opinion. I think it could go two ways. You either equalise the distances at something in between, like instead of 8 and 15, maybe both genders run 10 or 12K, yeah, which incidentally is what the IAAF have done for the World Cross Country Championships. Or alternatively, you could offer both distances to both sexes. You could have a short and long course championships and then everybody could choose.
I think that's a really interesting kind of creative solution to it, isn't it? Say, you can have 9K or 15K, and whether you're a man or woman, you can pick the event that suits you on the day.
Another reason for that is the very long events actually discriminate against some of the men's. At the Southern Championships, there's a 90-minute cutoff for the men's 15K. Now, there are many, many male club runners, some of the older runners, some of the newer runners, who can't run 15K in 19 minutes. They're effectively being excluded from the event. Nobody should be either limited or excluded simply because of their gender in the 21st century.
You mentioned the IAAF have altered it for the world. So how would you expect the changes to be brought forward then across the board?
What I would really love to see is organisations like UK Athletics, the English Cross Country Association, the South of England Athletics Association, people like that, to show some leadership, to say, look, the IAAF have changed it. We live in the 21st century. We want to set an example to our young athletes, particularly our junior girls, that they're capable of just the same as the boys. Let's move forward. Let's not wait to be dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
Yeah, and I understand more that you're kind of voting with your feet and you're actually not going to take part in cross-country while the rules stay as they are. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I've decided that I will only compete in events where men and women run over equal distances. I'm lucky that my club competes in two local leagues, the Chingford League and the Run Heart Sunday League, where we do compete over the same distances, and I will continue to enter those events. And in the meantime, I've never been comfortable running at these events where the women don't run the same distance. I feel cheated and shortchanged.
Have you tried contacting any authorities about this, Maud?
Yes, I have. I've written to UK Athletics and the English Cross Country Association, making many of the same points I've made here. And I did get a personal response. I'll give him that. But, you know, very much saying, oh, well, you know, if we get enough people writing in, you know, then we'll put it to the clubs. Lots of people quite like it this way. I was hoping for a bit more leadership, quite honestly. Yeah. I was hoping that, you know, rather than waiting until, the tide of change just runs over them, just make it happen.
Yeah. I think one of the things that stands out for me about running is it's so gender neutral, isn't it? It's not... Men, it's something that men and women do together. Men and women are both fantastic at it. The longer the distance, the more equal we are.
That's very true. Last year I ran an ultra marathon over 42 miles-ish, which was won outright by a woman. The differences do narrow as the distances go.
So it's one more compelling reason for the distances to be the same, I think. Maud, thank you very, very much for coming in to talk about that on the podcast. I think that's a really, really interesting topic, and I think it should be discuss more, and I'm sure our listeners will have.
Yeah, we would actually love to hear from listeners on this. If you could send in your thoughts and opinions to podcast@runnersworld.uk, do you think it's high time that men and women raced at equal distances for cross country, or should we stick with tradition? So let us know. Twitter @runnersworld.uk. Thanks again, Maud. That was really, really interesting.
Runner's World Podcast.
In 2014, aged 49, Kevin Webber was told he had terminal prostate cancer and was given just 2 years to live. Such news would stop most men in their tracks. Kevin, instead, decided to run. Since his diagnosis, Kevin has completed multi-day ultramarathons in the Sahara Desert, 15 marathons in 15 days, and next month will head to the Arctic for the 6633 Ultra. Through his running, Kevin has raised tens of thousands of pounds for Prostate Cancer UK and hopes to increase awareness about the disease. Kevin, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Hi, thank you.
So let's go back to November 2014 when you received your diagnosis. What are your memories of that day?
That day was pretty awful because I'd spent the previous 3 months having loads of tests and biopsies, and the biopsies are really not much fun for prostate cancer. And I knew something was probably not quite right. About 7 days before, Alvin Stardust had died of prostate cancer. And until that stage, everyone said prostate cancer is curable. And suddenly there was someone that I knew from like the 70s, I knew of him from the 70s, and it kind of made it very real. And I got into the room, and the doctor just sat down with my wife, and the doctor just said, oh, I'm really sorry, you've got advanced prostate cancer, it's spread. You know, you've probably got 2 years to live, if you're lucky, 3 to 4. Don't think 10, and he actually said it twice, don't think 10, you know, so it was kind of quite emotional, lots of tears, my wife and I, you know, burst into tears, and weren't expecting it at all, and kind of that was it, my life was over. I then left that doctor, who was a urologist, and went to an oncologist, who then told me that they were going to give me chemotherapy and radiotherapy thereafter, and the combination of those things in my mind, from what I'd heard, plus a two-year unpleasant endgame, meant my life was already over. So, you know, 2 years of sort of treatment. So that was it. Life was ended. And I then spent pretty much 2 years in my mind thinking I'm going to be dead, and the next 2 months most mainly in tears.
So you've left the room and you've seen different doctors to give you different diagnoses. Did you have a particular moment? Was there an epiphany when you suddenly realised that you had to do something off your own back with this?
I always liked running. I ran quite a bit when I was in my 20s, but never further than a half marathon. You know, I always had massive respect for anyone that could run any further because I had nothing left in the tank after 13.1 miles. And about 7 years before, one of my wife's friends had an untimely death, and my wife said, "You always wanted to run a marathon, never did." So I kind of learned to run again because I'd been injured, and ran a few marathons. And then I also did one ultra marathon, ran from London to Brighton in 2014. But that was, I was kind of a two or three big race a year person, as in big races with a couple of marathons and an ultra marathon. That's how I saw the future panning out. And then the week before I started chemotherapy, so in early January 2015, I went for a long run, about 20 miles. And I remember running, crying, because I just thought I would never run again. I just thought, this is it. I'm going to start chemotherapy and that's it. My life is over. It's all rubbish. And so started chemotherapy on the 13th of January, shuffled back from the hospital, got in my house, had a dinner, went to bed, just thinking that's it. And you don't sleep when you have chemotherapy because they pump you full of steroids beforehand. So they're like, it's like having like 25 cans of Red Bull. You're just absolutely wired. Next morning I got up and it was cold and it was just miserable outside. And I said to my wife, "I'm going for a run." And she said, "You know, you can't, doctor." I said, "Well, doctor didn't say I can't." He just said, "Didn't say anything at all." She said, "Well, you never asked him." So I said, "But I've got a choice." And that was my epiphany. I said, "I have a choice. I can give up now and just do nothing and be like, sadly, most people are when they have something bad in their life, not just cancer, but when bad things happen, people just give up. Or I can, you know, try and enjoy some of my life." And so I went for a run and I managed 3 miles. So when you think a week before I did 20, all I could do was 3. I came back feeling really sick and really tired, but so happy that I'd done it. I just thought, I can still run. It didn't matter how far it was, I can still run. And that was the epiphany. That was the bit that changed everything. Because then suddenly, instead of I've got 2 years to sort of slowly die, it became, well, actually, I've got 2 years to get out there and run as much as I can. So I just sort of kept on running, and I ran a bit further and a bit further, and I saw my oncologist again. And I said, "Look, I'd entered the Brighton Marathon before I was diagnosed. What do you reckon?" And he said, "No, you can't do that." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, because no one ever runs a marathon on your chemotherapy." So I said, "Look, I really want to do it." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you can train for it, you can run it." So I got home and Googled my kind of chemotherapy and running marathons to see if I get some help. And I couldn't find anyone in the world that had done it. So now I kind of knew why he said what he said. But I kept on training, kept on going. I had a few setbacks and I'm in hospital a few times on drips and stuff because I had problems with the chemotherapy. But April 2015 came along and I managed to get on the start line of the Brighton Marathon and did it. And I did it in, I think, 4:38. And the previous year I'd run Brighton, my fastest ever time, which was 3:52, I think. And so kind of a year and chemotherapy and cancer, it's kind of cost me an hour. But I was so happy, and a lot of my friends came down to watch me. They kept popping up all over the place. It was a great marathon. My mate Jim ran it with me, and he was desperate to do a sub-4-hour marathon, but he stayed the whole way with me, so he kind of smashed his option, his one opportunity, as he saw it, to do a sub-4-hour marathon to run around with me. We met a few other guys running for Prostate Cancer UK as well. Really emotional, you know, lots of tears, but just when I crossed the finish line, you know, there is no better feeling than finishing a race when you think you're absolutely never going to do it. So I got home just so pleased with myself, and then got a phone call from one of my wife's friends, and she said, "Look, I can get you a kind of last minute place in the London Marathon in 2 weeks' time. Do you fancy it for you and Jim?" And I thought, you know, two marathons in 2 weeks, well, let's do it. So I said, "Go on then." So we got there, and actually I felt much stronger that day. And we were doing 4-hour marathon pace for about 12 miles. And I realised I could carry on a bit, but I'd never do it. And I said to Jim, "Look, you just go and do it." And so he finished in, I think, 3:59. So he was like over the moon. And I kind of did the last 12, 13 miles on my own. But in the London Marathon, you're never on your own. And again, whenever I see a Prostate Cancer UK shirt, I always stop and ask them why they're running. And I always thank them because they don't actually realise. Often with prostate cancer, the person's older, so they can't run. So it's often their kids, their daughters or their sons that are running. And I say, why are you running? They say, it's for my dad or whatever. And then you say, well, actually, you're also running for my kids. And they look at me and I say, why is that? I say, well, because you know, you're raising money that will hopefully mean that by the time my kids are my age, they won't have to worry about prostate cancer. And that normally makes them burst into tears, which is quite quite interesting. That's not why I do it, but actually, I think people often raise money for the reason that they're doing it for, but it's such a wide reason. The money never just goes to one person. It always goes to the cause. So they're helping so many more people than just the one. So, yeah, so I did the London Marathon. Actually, I was faster. I think I did that in, I think it was about 4:28 or something. So I was really, really pleased with my time for that. And then it was kind of went and told the doctor, got back and said, oh, I've run these two marathons and since I last seen him. And he said, oh, that's a bit amazing. I'd never thought you'd do that. So like, what are you going to do now then? And I think he thought I was going to say I was going to do some park runs, you know. And I said, well, I've entered this race. And he said, what's that? I said, it's called the MDS. What's that? I said, well, it's like a marathon on Sunday, a marathon Monday, a marathon Tuesday, a double marathon Wednesday, a marathon Friday, half marathon Saturday in the Sahara, carrying everything on your back, 50 degrees centigrade. And he looked at me and said, why would anyone want to do that, let alone someone in your situation? And it was just great. And that was it. It became my focus, you know, my reason to live and to train. I had no idea if I was going to get to the start line, but it was just an opportunity to give me something in the shortish term to aim for.
Obviously, you completed the marathon to Saab, and then, as I said in the intro, 15 marathons in 15 days. It's incredible, and I wondered if there's a kind of message that you're looking to convey through your running.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of medical things that prove that running releases endorphins and makes you feel good, and that's absolutely true. But it also makes you feel alive. It makes you feel you can do something. It's kind of me time. So when I'd go running, I'd often start with a head full of stuff, and as you do when you run, after sort of 20 minutes, you're so tired that everything's gone, and then you can kind of pull one thing.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
At a time and really analyse it and make it better. And by the time I got home, what my wife would say is that, you know, if I was a bit moody or down before, I'd come back and I'd be so high and I'd be like trying to plan the next run. So, you know, although my wife, I think, misses me when I'm out doing these races, she knows that the races actually keep the family going, because that ability to go out there and do something for me, that also raises some money for a good cause, it also spreads awareness. And it's not just about prostate cancer, okay, that's what I've got, but it's anything. You know, you might have just lost your job, you might have had, I don't know, a relationship issue, you might have another family member is ill or something bad happened, but you haven't got to give up. And that's what I've realised. You know, you can still enjoy today. Now, last night was a really good example. I was watching telly and they talked about the supermoon, which I didn't know was... So I thought, that's it, I'm going to go out. So I went out just to look at the moon. And, you know, I'm not a wolf, I didn't bark it or anything or howl at it. But it's just such a joyous thing. And then I thought, well, actually, I'm going to jog up the road then. I didn't have my running gear on. Just thought, I'm just going to have a little jog. So I kind of jogged up the road in my jeans and the wrong shoes. But just felt so good. And so so natural now, since the beginning of humans, there's been a moon up there, and you can run when you want to. So that's what I did, and it's just brilliant. I mean, running is just fantastic.
Have you thought about legacy, Kevin? Have you thought about kind of what you want your legacy to be?
I know this is going to sound a bit strange. Nowadays, I put myself in the public eye a bit, but I'm not naturally extrovert. I'm extrovert if I know you, but if I don't, I'm quite introvert. But I've realised I have an opportunity to try and make or encourage people to do things differently. So as a legacy, I don't actually want a bronze of me in Trafalgar Square on the spare plinth. That's not what I'm after. But I wouldn't mind, if nothing else, you know, one, raise a few quid, because I think, you know, my boys are 17 and 13, and more men are getting prostate cancer when they're in their late 30s, early 40s, which never used to happen that much. So I reckon I've got 20 years to help Prostate Cancer UK develop things so that they won't have to worry about it being a killer. It might still be there, but it hasn't got to kill you if they can get it right. So that's one legacy. The next is I want more and more men to find out about it. Already I've had people email me and said, I heard you speak, or I've read something that you've written, and you know what, I was going up the night for a wee, so I went to the doctors, and you know what, I had prostate cancer, and I would never have gone without reading your story, and because I went early, I can be cured, and so now I won't die of it. And so I've already, you know, sounds big-headed, but I've already saved people's lives, and there's nothing more you can do in life for that than that. So as a legacy, I've already kind of created some stuff. And I guess it moved on, I said, from prostate cancer, anything. I want people just to make the most of it. You know, I've been working with someone to try and produce a website, which is just it's supposed to be inspirational, to try and make people to think about how they can live their lives better. And it's not trying to lecture them, it's just, you can always find something good in a bad day. So the website is actually makethemostof.it. And if someone goes there, you'll see it's my story and what I've done and how I got through the bad days and how I live in short-term chunks. You know, I have monthly blood tests. So every month I live in a four-week window. So I had the results yesterday and it was a good result. So the drugs are still working. Brilliant. So now I can think about next month. And so I'm going to be like alive and healthy for another month, so I can really plan. And actually the reality is a good blood test probably means you got 3 months, because it takes a couple of months for it to go bad and affect you. So I can start thinking, well, actually now get the doctor to sign off my medical form for the 6633, which he's done, so I can do that in March. I come back and I'm home for 2 weeks, and I'm off to the Marathon des Sables again. So I'm going to go from minus 50 degrees centigrade to plus 50 C in the space of 2 weeks. And I think, actually, now I can do that as well. Whatever goes wrong, I now can do those two things. And that's, you know, it's running again. I say running, you know, at the moment, when you do those really, really long races, it's kind of run-walk, but mainly fast walking. So sometimes I think, am I a runner anymore? Because some of these races are so long, only the real, real elite people manage to run a lot of them. But I know I'll run some of them, so I'm still a runner, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think some of our listeners won't be familiar with the 6633 Ultra. It's pretty full-on, as you say, minus 50. Can you give us a little overview of that race?
So the 6633, allegedly, is one of the five hardest races out there. You know, the Marathon des Sables was claimed to be. What makes the Marathon des Sables hard is that you can enter it without any qualifications at all. There's no pre-qualification, you're going to pay the money. And so you haven't got to be fit at all, and you can rock up, and that makes it pretty hard if you're not fit. The 6633 is hard because it is 350 miles. It's non-stop, so it's not a stage race. So when you start, the clock's ticking all the way through to the end. You don't have a tent, so basically you go for about 15 to 18 hours a day, and then when you get knackered, you just roll your sleeping bag out on a sleeping mat in the snow, sleep for 3-4 hours, get up, and then do it again. There are checkpoints, but like some of them are 85 miles apart. You know, on the Marathon des Sables, the checkpoints are like 12k apart. It's a very different race. And when you run out of water, you just have to melt snow. So, you know, that takes time. It's bizarre. You know, I'm using gas for my heat, and actually I have to put paraffin blocks and set fire to them under the gas canister to make the gas canister warm enough so the gas doesn't freeze so I can melt snow. So it's just so many things I had to learn. It's a tough race, and most years, about 7 or 8 people finish out of the 25 to 30 entrants. Some years, no one finishes. So, you know, to me, it's just I'm going to put my foot in the start line, and I can't tell you how far I get. And I don't mind, because I know I've got an advantage. I've got two advantages. One's I'm mentally strong. You know, if I can sit there with chemotherapy, I can certainly get cold. Secondly, I have an advantage that I can't do it next year, maybe. So whereas someone might think, oh, I've got a bit of a knee ache, let's give up now, and then let's train a bit harder for next year, I can't do that. So actually, if my knee hurts, I think, sod it, I'm just going to keep going and just see how far I go until my knee collapses, because that's, I don't really care. And someone talked about frostbite the other day, and frostbite's the biggest reason people drop out. And to me, and again, this sounds mad, but I don't care if I lose a finger, because I haven't got to worry about when I'm 80. You know, I'm 52 now. I won't need that finger when I'm 80. And yeah, whilst I don't want to lose a finger, don't get me wrong, I'm not. But if I do, oh, so what? It doesn't really matter. I can survive another year without a finger. That's what I've got to worry about. So that's cool. No, now I do that. I lose four fingers and five toes, and they'll find a cure, and I'll find I'm going to live to 80. But you know, hey, I'd take that.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on to the Runner's World podcast. It's absolutely incredibly inspiring to hear how you've reacted to some absolutely terrible news, and how you've kind of filled your life with joy and running. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
You're listening to the Runner's World podcast.
Joining us in the studio now is Will Watt, the founder of The Swimmer, a swim-run event that takes in a half marathon and four outdoor swims. We covered the event in the social movement section of February issue of Runner's World. In fact, Rick did it.
That's right. I took part in The Swimmer, so I've got first-hand experience of your event, Will.
I should actually, when you say founder, I founded it with a guy, Jonathan Cowie, who is a really good runner. And we swam together at Tooting through the winter. And Tooting has a brilliant swimming club, South London Swimming Club, and they do the thing called the Lido Crawl, which is from Tooting, going north, and it goes from Tooting to the Serpentine to the Men's Pond. But they do it on bikes or in cars. And, yeah, it's hard enough. It's December, November, so it's cold swim, so it's quite tough. So I did it on a bike, and I got to the end, which is the Men's Pond in Hampstead, which is where, as Rick knows, the swimmer starts. And we started cycling home, and I thought, actually, this is all downhill. I could probably run this. At a push, I'm not a great runner, but at a push, I could probably run this. And it reminded me of the film The Swimmer with Burt Lancaster, right, which is...
extraordinary kind of... It's a trippy 60s film, yeah.
It's quite a dark... slightly ironically, really, I was middle-aged. I'm middle-aged, and it's a sort of... It's a story. It's a John Cheever short story about a man's descent into sort of almost middle-aged crisis. So it was slightly appropriate in a horrible way in... So we thought, it reminds me of The Swimmer. So I went home and looked up the URL, and theswimmer.org was free. So I thought, oh, well, we're going to have to do this. And I was just chatting to Jonathan about the idea, and he said, I'll do it with you. So we did it in September 2012, and just did the route, just recce'd the route. And it's actually turned out to be a lovely route. I mean, you start in Hampstead, but then you see your first run is through Hampstead Heath at dawn, which is quite beautiful. Then you go over Primrose Hill and see the sunrise over London. Then you go down the hill through Regent's Park, which is quite a nice park, go past Baker Street, and then you have to go to the Serpentine, which is in Hyde Park. So the first half of it is, I think we describe it as a run through London's finest parks and pools, which it genuinely is. Yeah. Then from Serpentine onwards, we're running home back to South London, which is... It's slightly, how would you describe that?
Slightly more real.
Keeping it real, it's South London, isn't it? It's a bit more South London. So the north is very parks and leafy and lovely. And a lot of people actually pack it in at the Serpentine and go, well, that was great. And I mean, yeah, you probably missed the best. That's the best bit. The 6 miles after that is a bit of a slog down to Brockwell. But when you get to the end, we have started to sort of lay on bacon butties, coffee, sauna at Brockwell, which I think is Rick's local pool. They've got a great cafe there, so we lay on a bit of a spread. And then we've had film screenings in the pub afterwards as well with The Swimmer, and so people.
I mean,
can
you're watch. Really selling it to me. I'm actually quite.
You fancy it?
This. Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting that it's inspired by The Swimmer, but there is an important difference, isn't there? That film is at the height of the American summer, whereas you guys insist on it being a winter only UK event. I mean, it's freezing, Will.
It is, but I mean, it's slightly bizarrely. I was on my way here and I bumped into a really old friend of mine from college, and he said, oh, yeah, it's this time of year, just a bit down, a bit depressed. And I said, and he liked swimming at the Men's Pond. I said, you get in that pool, it'd be freezing. I said, look, you wait, you get in that cold water, and it just clears out all of the sort of mental fog of winter. And it's really addictive, cold swimming. So, it's, I mean, there's I can't remember. There's two doctors on the BBC, aren't there? And he did a thing on cold swimming. He was trying to sort of experiment with not prescribing drugs. So he prescribed somebody, you know, cold swimming for mental health.
Right.
And it is phenomenal because it just blows your mind. It literally blows your mind out. And you've gone, whoa! And you get an endorphin rush, which is slightly addictive for people, I think. And it is fantastic. I mean, I do it all year, every year. Don't get ill, don't get colds. You know, I haven't had anything for years just from cold swimming because it boosts your immune system. Obviously, to a lot of people, you look like a nut job. But if you go to any of these places that do it, like South London Swimming Club right. or Brockwell now, Do It Now, you do meet a lovely, eclectic bunch of people. And the swimmer, I mean, there's some cracking people, dude.
There are some characters. Well, there's the fittest vicar in London, Ben.
Wow.
Graham Buckle,
right.
The Reverend.
The Reverend right. Graham Buckle. And isn't there, there's a rumour, isn't there, that Graham's presence ensures good weather?
It's never rained. We've been doing it for 5 years, and every time it happens and Graham is on there, it never rains. There was literally one time where the forecast was dreadful. And we ran through London with rain passing us on the north, and it didn't rain. And it was like a miracle. And he is like, I mean, Graham, if he's listening, I did try and get him to come today, actually. He is a bit like an angel. He's this sort of wonderful sort of spiritual leader. I've made him chairman because he's, you know, he's got to be.
I was going to ask you about, because the swim is not a competitive event, but you'd classify it as a swim run, I guess, and which is a real growth thing.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think that like swimming and running go well together?
We didn't realise this at the time, but we think the swimmer is the first, in a very unofficial sense, swim run event in the UK. We didn't even know about swim run at the time we did it. Mm. But yeah, I think they do. And actually, particularly in winter, because everyone who does it, it's quite a long run, isn't it? It's about half a marathon, as you said in the intro. Mm. But the cold swim seems to take, it helps your legs recover. I mean, I am no runner. I'm no half marathon runner, and I can do it. And the cold bit seems to help with it.
It's like an ice bath, isn't it? Well, you know,
it is like the rugby boys when they get in the ice baths. Yeah, but it's not competitive in any sense at all. We have cake at the halfway point because you need the sugar rushes.
What kind of race?
yeah.
It's about the enjoyment, not the endurance. We say
nice.
Leave the Garmin at home.
But I do think swim run and the as a area is very interesting because I think a lot of people with the triathlon stuff actually it's the cycling part that. Is that it feels very sort of gear intense, and actually swimming and running are very simple sports, aren't they?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think triathlon is an excuse for middle-aged men in Lycra to spend like £6,000 on a bike, and quite honestly, their wife doesn't know that the difference between that and a 600-quid bike is just gear-led stuff. Yeah, now it's quite. Somebody said, "What was the phrase that you used the other day?" I was talking about triathlon. It just became a bit. It's just quite sanitised. Whereas I think what we do with the swimmer is, and with swim run as well. Mm. There's some great swim runs up in the Lake District and stuff. Yeah. It's a bit more an adventure.
Yeah. Well, this leads me on to the Scandinavian version
Attila.
So
people do.
I think you'll find it's pronounced
There's a load of people who've done the Attila. Jonathan, that I found it, was done the Attila, and we did have people. You can train for the Attila on the swimmer, and that means what you do is you turn up in a wetsuit, yeah. Ben, so you'd be fine.
Good.
But what you've got to do is do the whole... And people were turning up doing it in literally all this Attila kit, which is wetsuit, and they would just do the whole thing in their wetsuit. Mm. So it's quite an odd sight at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, because we run past Harvey Nichols and down that street where there's loads of sort of, you know, Versace underwear shops, and these people are coming out, and there's these people running past in wetsuits, and they're going, what the bloody hell are you doing? Yeah. So it was quite an odd sight at early on a Saturday morning in the heart of Knightsbridge.
Well, Will, thank you very, very much for coming on the Runner's World podcast. It's great to hear a bit more about the swimmer. And I would encourage any listeners who are kind of intrigued by what they've heard to give the swimmer a go. I mean, it sells out all the time, so you've got to be quick, haven't you, to get on?
Yeah, do I need to do the www.swimmer.org?
Yeah,
it's www.theswimmer.org. But yeah, it's popular. I don't do it full time. I'd love to sort of find a way to that, but it's just a fun hobby, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, good fun.
Great, well, thanks again, Will. Cheers.
Before we go this month, please send in your training questions. We want some input from you for our next Runner's World podcast. What would you like to know? Whether you're upping your mileage before a marathon, what to eat before a race, any of these questions, please email us at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk and we'll try and answer those questions for next month's show.
In the meantime, we'd like to say a quick thanks to our guests, Maud Hodgson, Kevin Webber and Will Watt, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded. For more from Runner's World, why not head to our website, runnersworld.co.uk, where you'll find more advice and inspiration from the wide world of running. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.